to the History of Fun, where we explore the hidden backstories of the things you love. My name is Ross Frushtick, and today I'm joined by Allegra Frank. Hey, Allegra.
Hey, Russ.
How are you?
My throat feels horrible.
Not enough zinc for Allegra, perhaps. Didn't load up on the zinc. Highly, highly recommend. It limits how long your cold is and how strong it is.
There's no medical science behind this whatsoever.
I'm a doctor, and you can take my advice as a doctor.
Okay.
Doctor of fun. We're also joined by Chris Plant, who is bringing a very interesting topic today. Very exciting.
Are you ready? I've got my elevator pitch.
Okay.
Puritans.
Love them.
Bill O'Reilly.
Oh, God.
Donald Trump.
Oh, boy.
Wow.
Is quite the gang.
On a journey today. Today, we're going to talk about the history of the War on Christmas, which I realized about 5 minutes before the show started. Fun? Debatable.
It is about a fun thing, and maybe the only war we could ever bring to this podcast, because wars by and large are not fun, and this one is indeed not fun, but it is about a fun thing, so maybe that's a loophole.
It's fun adjacent, right?
Yes.
I guess we could also do the time that everybody played soccer during World War II.
Yeah,
sure. Well, we're not doing that. We're doing the War on Christmas. So anyway, so the War on Christmas, a thing I did not know is that it is as old as the country itself. And
wow.
Not one of those ways where like, yeah, it's as old as the country itself. No, like, it's literally as old as the country itself. But, twist, it didn't look anything like it does today. There's kind of like War on Christmas 1.0. In War on Christmas 2.0.
Okay.
So a lot of the research on War on Christmas 1.0 comes from a book called The Battle for Christmas by Steven Nissenbaum. It was a shortlist finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. So
wow. Cool.
Pretty legit and very entertaining. It makes for like a good holiday read. It's not as academic as it might sound. Anyway, basically the where this book starts and where the War on Christmas starts in America is Christmas gets straight up illegal in Massachusetts from 1659 to 1681. There's like, no, you can't do it. And when I say that, I mean, you're still going to work. You don't get the day off. Mm. You can't party in the streets. You can't get too tipsy on mulled wine at an office party. None of it. It's all.
Did they have offices back then?
Yeah, like I like where they printed the printing presses at. You
sure,
know?
Yeah, duh,
sure.
Russ.
That sounds like an office.
Worked. I mean, geez,
Kathy comics on the walls. It was crazy.
So the Puritans' reason for this, it kind of adds up. They're like, hey, there's no biblical or historical justification for celebrating the birth of Christ on December 25th.
So I was going to say, this sounds a lot like remember the reason for the season, even back then, right?
Well, I mean, it's, yeah, it is reason for the season, but also, like, it's, like, beyond the reason for the season.
Whoa.
It's like, we shouldn't even have the season. The mistake you made was having the season.
Big mistake.
And this goes back, the church decided on the date of December 25th way back. In the 4th century. So it's been around for a long time. It was chosen because it marked the arrival of the winter solstice. So
yeah.
it was kind of glomming onto something from the very beginning.
The running theme of the season is people stealing other holidays and using it for their own holiday.
And just how great the winter solstice is.
Yeah.
So, Puritans rightly note, obviously, if you've listened to any other episodes from the season, that when they're talking about the season of the reason for the season, they're talking about pagan traditions just lathered in a sheen of Christian ideology. So they're very upset. And there's another thing about it is Christmas. I get it, right? Like, it has a bad reputation here in the States for like Christmas parties specifically getting a little, you know, wild. Christmas back then is straight up debaucherous. Like, even by today's standards, we'd be like, damn, no, wow, you're going way too hard. Let's like pull it back. We're talking like booze, just the most fatty meats. They didn't even like trim the fat off. They're just like, yeah, this looks good right there. Who cares about my tum-tum? We're talking about begging in the streets, which remember the episode we did on trick-or-treating and caroling being really just begging back in the days.
Sure.
The book, The Battle for Christmas, mentions the invasion of wealthy homes in fornication in the streets.
It was basically the purge.
Yeah, it was basically the purge. Well, I would say it's like if you mixed Fight Club with Panic Room.
Oh,
and you're like,
sure.
Oh, just a tour of the David Fincher catalog is basically what Christmas was. So, I mean, if you think about it, like today, Christmas has this bad rap for being a spree of capitalism. Then back in the day, it was almost the opposite. It was like a riot against the system where lots of power inversions, men would dress as women would dress as men. The poor would enter the homes of the wealthy. Everybody's like, give me cash, give me booze.
And but they were welcomed. It's not like they would break in always.
So it's interesting that you say that, because the argument that Nissenbaum makes was, and other historians have made, is that it may have been seen as a pressure release valve.
Oh, yeah.
Where the ruling class is like, well, if we just, you know, you give people a couple days a year,
right, give them some figgy pudding, and then everything works out.
Exactly. That's basically the process.
Yeah, it's smart.
So that's what's happening in the U.S., right? Meanwhile, in Europe, from about 1500 to 1800, people just cannot get enough of the Christmas season. And do you know why that is?
It's great. Santa?
That's part of it. Allegra, do you have any thoughts?
Because I was going to go with great too, honestly, but also everything you've just described about American Christmas sounds awesome. So,
so that's what you were personally supposed to do. That's what mostly people were doing in Europe. That's why it was like outlawed. But on top of all those great things that we just described, namely, I guess, home invasion, Allegra, terrifying that you would support crimes, is life was horrible. Like, life was just horrible. Every other day of the year, you woke up and you worked, and then you gave all your money to either the church or the government. And then they were like, hey, that's not enough. And you're like, okay, I guess I'll give you more until I die. But during Christmas, it was like this kind of, there wasn't a lot of work to do. You were ramping into the solstice. You had done all your harvesting. There was actual fresh meat because they would slaughter all the animals. And this was like that brief window before they covered it all in salt and preserved it for the year. And meat suddenly went from tasting amazing to tasting just absolutely awful. Beer and wine were ready because they had harvested wheat. It's like this rare time of there's a surplus of food and booze, and you can actually take a short minute away from work. So I think there's like a nice connection here, because you think of people in 2019 who are like, oh, Christmas starts so early, right? Oh, can you just let us like not have to have Christmas right now? When in reality, from the beginning, Christmas has been an argument from people who are like, hey, you know what sucks? The rest of the year, let us have like a month of fun and happiness. Why are you so awful in preventing us that moment?
I mean, in their defense, it's longer than a month at this point. Come on.
Well, no, it was always longer than a month. It would start around like Halloween, and it would end in early February.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Honestly, this sounds very much like my present day life of the other, 11, 10 months of the year are just not great.
And then you just party hard. You're eating fatty meats. You're drinking the flush wine.
Break into rich people's homes.
Mike Bloomberg does not know what you're doing in his house right now, recording this episode. To kind of like one more thing from this book that I just think is really a really smart point, was the idea of like being against Christmas on the 26th and thinking that you kind of know better than the church is inherently flawed. And that the church kind of knew it was getting all along, right? Like, it's getting all these positive vibes. It knew when it associated with the winter solstice what that was. Mm. It's riding that energy and that high, and that they're inherently bound to each other. Nissenbaum put it as like this, which is, Christmas has always been an extremely difficult holiday to Christianize, which is perfect, right?
Yeah,
that's what they're doing.
Christmas they do is a run separate thing. Contrary to basically every major tenet of Christianity in a lot of ways. I mean, the generosity is nice, but like, there's a lot of other things that it doesn't seem to jibe with.
Yeah, which I think is religious holidays often as secularized. But I guess the argument you could maybe even make is that because it did glom onto the winter solstice, is effectively the Christianization of the winter solstice, mm-hmm. which makes it from the get-go kind of an impossible task.
Yeah.
So that's the early days. Eventually, Christmas comes back, obviously. Twist. Survives the Puritans. By the mid-19th century, it's starting to get recognized at state level. This is from Time Magazine. Several older, highly industrialized states declared Christmas a legal holiday in the mid-19th century. Massachusetts makes a good case study. With a burnout rate skyrocketing during the Industrial Revolution, one state legislator argued that lack of leisure time was literally killing workers.
Yo.
I mean, probably true.
It's real. Yeah.
So the idea is that it may have actually came at a commercial level of like, hey, we just need, rather than we need them to go to church, we just need these people to like get a day off work or else they will die.
So we're saying that like during the Revolutionary War, like people were not celebrating Christmas?
It state by state.
Oh, changed and state by state. Because obviously the Puritans, like the rule of the Puritans did not last through the 1700s.
But the idea was that it was more, I'm talking about it as a state level. So again, like individuals celebrated it in their own ways.
Got it.
Establishing it at the state level, because that's where the war on Christmas truly was all along.
At Plymouth Rock.
In our hearts and on the Constitution. So in 1870, Christmas becomes a federally recognized holiday, which it still is today. Hasn't changed since 1870.
Who did that? What president was that?
That was my trivia for you.
Oh.
Wow, Russell.
Boy.
Do you know who it was?
Ooh, boy. 1870. So, like, that's, I think that's post-Lincoln.
What do you mean you think?
I'm not 100% sure when Lincoln got killed, but I think it is post-Lincoln. I'm going to guess. No, it's before Cleveland. William Henry Harrison. He did it in those 30 days that he was alive.
Good guess. Do you have a guess, Allegra?
Oh, God. I want to say literally the only things I can think of are just generic white, like generic white American man names. So I'm just like, Johnson.
you will be thrilled to know of all of the people who could make Christmas legal, it was none other than President Ulysses S. Grant.
Makes sense.
This is from another timepiece. Some have theorized that the law was meant to unite North and South during the height of the Reconstruction period after the Civil War. The Northern publishing houses that produced Christmas imagery and circulating the latest customs and traditions led the change for the holiday. So maybe it was to unite the North and the South after the war and give something that everybody could share. Or maybe it was for the North to make a lot of money off the South with all this merch that they had. Who's to say?
That, you know? That huge wreath imagery or industry booming in Massachusetts.
Oh, my gosh. Anyway, so that's War on Christmas 1.0. We did it. You know, Christmas becomes a legal holiday. Everything's gravy. Surely this won't ever cause a problem in the history of America.
No, that's the end.
That's the end.
Episode's over.
Surely the history of America won't come back to haunt the present of America. Twist, it does. The War on Christmas 2.0. 1920. Enter Henry Ford.
Oh, gosh.
Business tycoon.
Iconic, not nice guy.
Iconic automaker and notorious anti-Semite. He produces pamphlets in the 1920s called The International Jew, The World's Foremost Problem. And the dude goes bonkers with hateful attacks and conspiracy theories. Snopes has a lot of great writing on this. So if you would like to read more about Henry Ford, I will try to limit how much Ford gets in this podcast because he's truly a hateful bigot. But they have a lot more to go off of. Really, what Ford is upset about is that some Jewish leaders had questioned the teaching of Christianity in public schools. It's a First Amendment issue. One that had been argued in the courts a decade earlier than this. But hey, what does time or the law mean to someone like Henry Ford? He says some awful things. I will just read one of them, just so you think about it every time you buy a Ford.
Lovely.
People sometimes ask why 3 million Jews can control the affairs of 100 million Americans in the same way that the Jewish students can abolish the mention of Christmas and Easter out of schools containing 3,000 Christian pupils.
Yep, it's all them.
Not real. In these pamphlets, he was always like, I don't know if you noticed, but last year it was pretty hard to buy a Christmas card. No, it wasn't, Henry. And like, at all, nobody had trouble. Literally not a single person
it's
had trouble.
It's just because Henry was trying to buy one on Christmas.
I love the idea of him buying up all the Christmas cards to like support his Christmas theory. He just has a room full of Christmas cards.
Look how tough it is.
It's also like, I mean... This is the cliche, the magic of terrible racism, totally illogical. But Ford in one pamphlet will be like, oh, the Jews are out to destroy Christmas. And then the next one will be like, the Jews, they make all of the money off of Christmas because they own the department stores.
Right.
It's like, Henry, you got to choose a lane and stick with it. It's a little too obvious. Continuing the story, you're going to notice a trend pretty quickly.
Oh boy.
In terms of who has issues with Christmas. I'll just spoil it right away. It's anti-Semites. The 1950s, the communists, or quote unquote the communists, 1959 pamphlet from the John Birch Society titled "There Goest Christmas" with a question mark and an exclamation point at the end.
Wow.
Oh,
emphatic.
So he's shocked and alarmed.
Well, John Birch is not actually just one person. It's a society. So, like, his name isn't John Birch Society.
Oh, got it.
Mr.
Well,
Society.
Well, they use an interrobang very well.
Sure. They say, one of the techniques now being applied by the Reds to weaken the pillar of religion in our country is the drive to take Christ out of Christmas. And this is from Time magazine. The John Birch Society also assailed the United Nations as fanatics who were trying to, quote, poison the 1959 Christmas season with their high-pressure propaganda. Here's another quote on the UN from that same pamphlet. UN fanatics, what they now want to put over on the American people is simply this. Department stores throughout the country are to utilize UN symbols and emblems as Christmas decorations.
Whoa,
the
so
obvious
like that
subtext.
Globe with the like plants around it?
Yeah, the subtext here is that the UN represents globalism,
yeah,
which represents Jewish people. Even
that's
like,
interesting because I'm like, I don't know, whenever I hear about like McCarthyism, I feel like I don't remember hearing a ton about the UN specifically as like
so the John Birch Society, even by like its contemporaries, was fringe.
Okay.
It still actually exists. It probably won't surprise you that it is notorious for conspiracy theories and anti-Semitism, even to today.
Wow.
Yeah, it hasn't been doing super well since the 70s. I think it's like done average, but I guess it's had an uptick since President Trump.
I like that it did funny. Average.
It's so okay. Average for a hate group or something adjacent to a hate group.
Yeah.
So that brings us to the modern era. We're just trucking along. Trivia. What year was Christmas challenged as a federal holiday in the U.S. courts?
How high did it go?
It went to a district court.
Okay.
I'm going to say 1974.
Oh, I was going to guess the 72. I'll say 78.
You know when is the best time to party? Like, it's 1999.
Wow.
Wait, really? Yep.
1999.
And it was challenged as a federal holiday?
So.
Who is behind this? The Jews?
So, Ganulin versus United States. The charge is Christmas Day's federal status violates the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. The Establishment Clause is a clause of the First Amendment, the freedom of speech. It's legal stuff. It gets complicated.
Church and state?
The bit you need to know is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. I gotta be honest. They make kind of a point.
So, from a wiki on this case, Judge Susan DeLotte of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Ohio ruled that the Christmas holiday has become largely secularized. And because of that, by giving federal employees a paid vacation day on Christmas, the government is doing no more than recognizing the cultural significance of the holiday.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
Which, if you circle back to the things that we were saying at the beginning, is it was basically secularized from the drop.
Right.
Yeah. It was initially a celebration of the winter solstice.
At that point, like, good luck, like, ripping a holiday away from people after they've had it for 300 years.
Here's the thing you're not ready for.
Oh, no.
Judge DeLotte gave that decision as a Dr. Seuss poem.
Wait, what?
Part of the decision is a Dr. Seuss
so
poem.
So good.
Which I will now read to you.
Thank you. I'm very happy.
The court will address plaintiffs' seasonal confusion, erroneously believing Christmas merely a religious institution. Whatever the reason, constitutional or other, Christmas is not an act of Big Brother. Christmas is about joy and giving and sharing. It is about the child within us. It is most about caring. One is never jailed for not having a tree, for not going to church, for not spreading glee. The court will uphold seemingly contradictory clauses. 826 decreeing the establishment and, quote, Santa, both worthwhile clauses.
Oh, boy.
We are all better for Santa, the Easter Bunny, too, and maybe the Great Pumpkin, to name just a few. An extra day off is hardly high treason. It may be spent as you wish, regardless of reason. The court, having read the lessons of Lynch, refuses to play the role of the Grinch. There is room in this country, and all our hearts too, for different convictions and a day off too.
That is pretty excellent.
What?
It's an exceptional decision. And I will not go into it because we could do a whole podcast on it. But there is a good deal of writing about how this is actually legally sound on top of being just a good poem.
Well, but also I'm sure there's the rest of the decision is like a normal.
Sure. But I mean, this also actually captures the bulk of the decision. It's wild. Gets off to a rocky start. A little bit of kind of a slant rhyme up top.
Yeah, the meter's not great either.
It really ends on a strong note, though.
It does.
Wait, I just have to ask. Okay.
Yeah.
So when this poem was being read, was this like shocking to people, or they were like, no, okay, this is normal and fine?
Well, they don't usually read the decisions in court for this stuff. It's just printed, right?
I don't know, man. I think also like distribution of this sort of thing, you know, in the internet days, this would be huge. But I think,
even early, I'm sure it got a lot of press when it first happened. But yeah, usually these sorts of decisions are not, it's not like they come back a day later and give the decision. It'll be like weeks.
They present their poem in front of the jury.
Yeah. But what I also love about it is the argument is basically like, hey, no pressure. Like, it is, the poem is still kind of anti-war on Christmas of like, it's just a day off, do whatever you want.
Right.
You know, if it brings you joy, great. If it doesn't, like, watch Netflix all day, not really a problem. It's a free day off. I'm not going to take that away from you.
Yeah, that's pretty chill, man.
Yeah.
I like it.
This week on The Gray Area, writer Derek Thompson makes his case that everything has become a cult. Well, almost everything. Is Taylor Swift the closest thing we have to a mass cult today?
No, I think she's the closest thing we have to Christianity. It's
me. Find out if you're in a cult this week on The Gray Area, wherever you get your podcasts.
So, speaking of things that aren't chill, now to the rest of the piece. So, because of, you know, this case, or not because of it, but maybe adjacent to it, the war on Christmas people just start ramping up. And that same year, Peter Brimelow, who, another recurring theme of this piece, a dude too conservative for mainstream conservative publications, launches a recurring feature/contest thing on his website, vdare.com, that showcased Offenders and the War on Christmas. Some context about vdare.com. Southern Poverty Law Center classified it as a hate group. So,
cool.
So there's that. From Time Magazine, the inaugural villain was, this is in the timepiece on it, the inaugural villain as was the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which earned the dubious honor for hosting a holiday party dubbed a celebration of holiday traditions.
Uh-oh.
How dare they?
We're going to get tagged for this whole podcast season.
Yeah. Oh, the following year, Amazon.com became a target of Brimelow's wrath for subjecting consumers to the non-denominational greeting, Happy Holidays.
Yeah, it's terrible.
So the format goes on to serve as a contest with all sorts of people participating, namely supporters of eugenics and more anti-Semites, both of who won various years. The fringe groups, of course, as we have seen recently, are kind of like magnetic poles. So when he does this, everybody's like, whoa, chill. Like,
yeah,
that's a lot. You are embarrassing us. But of course, you know, the further the extreme, the more gradual the center kind of gets pulled towards it. So this goes from being too extreme to being pretty normal in about 2 years.
Yeah, it's also, I mean, it makes sense why they latch on. So you have these like right wing, you know, anti-Semite, neo-Nazi, whoever is doing this, but you pick a topic that is not, we want to kill all the Jews. You pick a topic that's, we miss Christmas, and how they used to say Merry Christmas in the Gap.
Yes.
And then you can get the people that are like, yeah, I do too. I miss hearing Merry Christmas in the Gap. And then suddenly those people realize that they're aligned with anti-Semites. It's like, whoopsie.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Well.
So eventually the campaign just gets fully adopted by Fox News and people who either work within Fox News or are part of it. In 2005, we get The War on Christmas, How the Liberal Plot to Ban the Sacred Christian Holiday is Worse Than You Thought. It's not my favorite book. It's by John Gibson, and it serves as this sort of urtext for like dopey, awful War on Christmas books cottage industry. Like every year, if you Google War on Christmas, or not Google it, put it in Amazon search bar, oh my, you are not for want. You could build an advent calendar of War on Christmas books. Sarah Palin published one. It has recipes. Oh, I encourage
recipes.
You to not buy it, but maybe peek through it at the library. Gibson himself has actually claimed to be shocked by kind of the political storm this book unleashed. And he blames two things when talking to the New York Times. He blames the provocative
himself?
Title.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was going to say he's probably partially to blame.
Well, he doesn't blame himself. He blames the title. And do you have any other guess?
Jews?
I was going to say liberals.
No, he actually blames Bill O'Reilly,
Oh, swerve.
Wow. Papa Bear.
When it comes to modern rallying over the war on Christmas, Bill O'Reilly is G-O-A-T. He's the goat.
Really?
There is nobody can lay a finger on his butterfinger of excellence. O'Reilly and also to some degree Sean Hannity, they are PO'd around this time of like 2005 or so, that corporate brands like Walmart are gradually adopting strategies that expand how they both display holidays and address them in their stores. Mm. You know, plans to make inclusivity a priority for all of the people who come there. They still sell Christmas trees and all these other things, but they also sell other things. And they're not happy. This diatribe is sourced by Snopes, and it's good. So I'll just skim through it. This is Bill O'Reilly. I can't do a Bill O'Reilly voice. I really
good,
think
good.
Good.
Don't try.
doing it
so
live.
This was on his show, though?
This is on his show.
Okay.
All over the country, Christmas is taking flack. In Denver this past weekend, no religious floats were permitted in the holiday parade there. In New York City, Mayor Bloomberg unveiled the holiday tree, and no Christian Christmas symbols are allowed in the public schools. Federated department stores Macy's have done away with the Christmas greeting Merry Christmas. Now all this anti-Christian stuff is absurd and may even be a bias situation. Love when people drop the bias word. But the real reason it's happening has little to do with Christmas and everything to do with organized religion. Here we go.
Oh boy.
Secular progressives realize that America, as it is now, will never approve of gay marriage, partial birth abortion, euthanasia, legalized drugs, income redistribution through taxation, and many other progressive visions because of religious opposition. But if the secularists can destroy religion in the public arena, the brave new progressive world is a possibility. That's what happened in Canada.
So
what?
Whoa.
So the idea is it's
Santa like, is keeping the tide back.
Well, like it's like kind of hard for me to parse. Basically, I think what he's saying is if liberals destroy Christmas and then other religious holidays,
yeah,
religion won't be able to take the hit. Religion itself will collapse and then cease to be the barrier that has protected America from progressive
legislation. Right. No one will know what's right and wrong without the guidance of Christmas and religiosity, essentially.
Yeah, effectively.
What happened in Canada?
Liberal agendas got passed, I think, is like the argument.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Okay. Yes. Healthcare.
Yeah. So at this point, the people cast as against Christmas, quote, against, and the war on Christmas become the boogeymen of just conservative talking heads. So immigrants, progressive brands, the ACLU, secular Jews, groups like the American Family Association, run annual lists drawing literal battle lines for the war on Christmas. They have a naughty and nice list, so you know who you can shop with.
Oh, good.
The criteria. The AFA reviews up to 5 areas to determine if a company is, quote, Christmas-friendly in their advertising. Print media, so like newspaper inserts, broadcast media, radio, television, website, social media, Facebook, Twitter, and or... depending on their time, I guess, personal visits to the store. If a company's ad has references to items associated with Christmas, trees, wreaths, lights, etc., it was considered as an attempt to reach Christmas shoppers. So your threshold is like trees.
That's all it takes.
I mean, the wild thing about it is, again, like if you think about pagan roots of the holiday, they're not even saying the things that are like associated with Christianity. They're just saying, just throw up a wreath. That's all it is.
Yeah, that's all it takes.
It's wild. This year, Family Dollar, The Gap, PetSmart, Staples, naughty list.
Bad.
On the marginal list, Starbucks.
Okay.
Starbucks. So
really? Because yeah. Starbucks for a very long time was the like poster child yeah. of anti, because they had the Happy Holidays on the cup.
Yeah.
And people freaked out.
They have been on the naughty list many times.
Okay.
Many times. But this year, something clicked.
You don't know what it was?
I think they probably put a wreath on on like a sure. mug or something. Mm. And then people were like, got it. We are.
But in that wreath, okay. a dreidel.
That's buried in it.
It's like almost there. Not quite.
Why is my coffee cup covered in UN logos?
Here's what I'm going to say.
Uh-huh.
And we keep this podcast very PG. So I'm going to PG this insult and just say, if someone says happy holidays to you and you are annoyed by that, you're an a-hole. Sorry, it's true. You're an a-hole. They were saying something nice to you and you had a problem with it. So you know what? Just deal with it and smile and be nice because they're trying to be nice to you.
You know what I like? Is it's like, it's the rare time where somebody's like, not good enough.
Like, you were could nice, have done more.
But not good enough. So, like when I said, it just becomes, the war on Christmas can be whatever you want it to be, the cause of it. My favorite, though, is in 2008, it was blamed for hurting the economy in the recession. Yes.
Wait, is this post-recession or before?
Well, this is like the holidays of 2008. So it's like...
Okay, so no one has any money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Wall Street Journal op-ed by Daniel Henninger, he claims, quote, "A nation whose people can't say Merry Christmas is a nation capable of ruining its own economy."
Yes.
And he goes on to drops that bomb. And then he's like, okay, now that I have that out there, I'm going to spend pretty much the rest of the entire piece just doing this very long and sloppy explanation of the, quote, good intentions that led to the housing collapse.
Oh, my God.
It's a journey.
Cool.
And then after he does all that, and he's like, oh, and that's how we got the recession, or whatever they were calling it at the time, because you wouldn't want to use the R word. He comes back and he ends with one more bomb. "Responsibility and restraint are moral sentiments. Remorse is a product of conscience. None of these grow on trees. Each must be learned, taught, passed down. And so we come back to the disappearance of Merry Christmas. It has been my view that the steady secularizing and insistent effort at de-religioning America has been dangerous. That danger flashed red in the fall into subprime personal behaviors by borrowers and bankers, who after all are just people. Northerners and atheists who vilify Southern evangelicals are throwing out nurturers of useful virtue with the bathwater of obnoxious political opinions. The point for a healthy society of commerce and politics is not that religion saves, but that it keeps most of the players inside the chalk lines. We are erasing the chalk lines."
Yeah.
Yeah. Wait. One final line.
Okay.
"Feel free. Banish Merry Christmas. Get ready for Mad Max."
Oh my
okay.
God.
Yeah. Now, yeah. I gotta be honest. That is the best, most convincing. I'm in, you're not, to be you're honest. I saw that movie. That was awesome. So if that's where we're going,
everyone is like reading and they're like, I don't know, this conflation's a little much. And then it gets to Mad Max and you're like, yeah, wait, that was a great movie.
I mean, look, it's not Beyond Thunderdome. It's just Mad Max. So like things haven't progressed that far. Mm-hmm. I'm fine with that.
You know what it does, though? It does loop back to anti-Semitism. We get Mel Gibson in there.
Oh, yeah. A little nod.
All roads.
Wow.
It's such a wild claim. I just love the idea that there's like the idea that secular people couldn't possibly have moral value, or that people who identify as Christian are somehow like, those are the people standing in the chalk lines. Donald Trump is doing A plus staying in the chalk lines. No.
Yeah, we the world has plenty of chalk lines. You can be once again an a-hole and ignore them, but you don't need religion to know where the chalk lines are. You just need to be a good person.
It's pretty wild. It's good. Okay, so we did it. We have made it to today.
Oh,
we are in the true throes of the war on Christmas. The war on Christmas is no longer a theoretical. It is happening. The President of the United States of America is in it. He has declared the war. He is fighting the war by himself, apparently.
Sure.
It has become effectively an unwritten part of the Republican Party platform. That isn't to say every Republican believes that the war on Christmas is a thing. It's just become a piece of leverage in elections.
Mm-hmm. And once again, for the same reason, because it is a easy concept to grok, even though it's a stupid concept, it's a thing that people can relate to, again, stupidly.
Yeah.
But.
Well, it's one of those also like an annoying thing. I just imagine people who are running as Republicans who get asked like, that war on Christmas, right? And they're like, yeah, sure. Like, do I really have to pander to this? Sure. The war on Christmas. Yeah. I've heard about it. People who are not coming from that place of just exhaustion, Donald Trump. Snopes notes that in the 2016 campaign for POTUS, then presidential nominee Donald Trump promised, if elected, he'd bring back, quote, traditional language like Merry Christmas. Spoilers. Traditional usually is a loaded word. He brought, obviously, that back the following year once he actually became president. And it's not great. He has just dropped it randomly. Like, it's kind of like his...
Like, May?
Yeah, I think it's just like when he's riffing, he doesn't know what to have. Kind of like a bad improv actor. He's
sure.
Like, oh, I'm also... yeah, we're married, and you hate me, and you're not my mom. Like, what? No. Why are you riffing like this? Stop. Just go back to whatever your point was. Be chill. Be cool. He's like, no, I can't. It's bad. But I think it's interesting that it's kind of like come back to Trump, because it basically ties the roots of the war on Christmas back to this kind of rise of populism and nationalism, pre-World War II, with anti-Semitism of Henry Ford, with this fear of, quote, globalization. And also, it like is perpetually tied to the fringe, right? I think what's weird in this case is the fringe became president.
Right.
But it is this thing that you always get the sense at every step of the way that there are those other people, like that I mentioned, who are like running on Republicans who are just like completely not here for it, but feel increasingly pulled in that direction by the fringe. And it's so bizarre to watch. I also think we kind of looped the loop in that the war on Christmas 1.0 began with the most extremely conservative Christians trying to limit public celebrations of Christmas to protect, quote, protect it. And it ends with extremely conservative Christians trying to champion Christmas, because that is their perception of how to protect it, but also to like make sure that secular beliefs don't get any like place at the table.
But also, it's important to remember that like they don't really care at all.
Yeah,
like this is just a leverage point of an us versus them thing. Donald Trump does not give an S about Christmas.
But there are people in this country who truly do think, like,
yes,
it's under attack.
Yeah, and that's who he's trying to reach, is the people that, like, take this stuff to heart.
Yeah.
But, like, these people are just using it as it's a talking point.
Yeah,
it's just like...
And one other thing. To make money.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because there's so much money. This is from a piece by Max Blumenthal in 2008. The Christmas Kulturkampf is a growth industry in a shrinking economy, providing an effective boost for conservative fundraising and a ratings bonanza for right-wing media, which it continues to be.
What is that? What is that Kampf?
I could guess, but do you really want me to?
No, I don't. No, I
think it's kind of implied by the structure of the sentence, but I don't want to get the specific of it wrong.
Yeah, that'd be humiliating. I think you're probably. I'm just confirming.
I think
that's fine.
The statement is, again, speaking of leverage, the war on Christmas can be brought up every holiday season to make sure that like Fox News has better ratings and yes. that people who are running can use that to fill up their coffers for their future platform.
And it's every single year. It's very reliable.
Yeah. Easy money.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and this also like isn't a secret. Bill O'Reilly, other people who argue that the war on Christmas is real have also openly said like, hey, this is a huge money-making thing, whether it's for like us or like stores. You, even if you don't believe in Christmas, you should celebrate. You should say Merry Christmas because you'll get more money, which is a choice. Here's the thing, though, about Trump and O'Reilly and everybody else that we talked about in this episode is they are fighting a losing battle and have been from the very beginning. All you have to do is look back in those history books, and you will find the same lesson repeated over and over, which, to quote Nissenbaum one more time, Christmas has always been an extremely difficult holiday to Christianize. you're not going to win it. And nor should these people, because I understand fear is a real thing, nor should people who fear that the war on Christmas is some evil strategy to remove Christianity from the public square, they should find comfort knowing that this supposed battle has raged for centuries. And as of today, about 3/4 of Americans identify as Christian. So it's not...
You guys are doing okay.
Numbers too bad. In fact, and here's where we're going to end it with a bit of trivia.
Oh boy.
Christians should thank the Jews for some of the magic of Christmas. Which songs, can you name three? Let's see if between the two of you, can you name three Christmas songs that were written by Jewish musicians?
Ooh,
iconic. They have to be biggies.
Baby, It's Cold Outside.
I'm going to say.
I don't have that on my list.
White Christmas.
Oh, that's a good guess.
Okay, keep going.
Okay.
Is that not on there?
Not on my list. I don't think that is.
Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer.
Yes.
Heck yeah.
Two more guesses.
Pretty good.
Two more.
Frosty.
No.
Winter Wonderland.
Not that I see. I realized this was a weird format because I can't fact check to see if they were also written by Jewish musicians.
What about all the songs from Nightmare Before Christmas?
Here's what I'll tell you. Interesting choice. the Christmas song. So chestnuts roasting over an open fire.
Sure.
Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. It's the most
Jingle
wonderful.
Bells?
What? It's no, let it snow, let it snow.
No, I know. I was guessing another Jingle
no,
Bells.
No, stop guessing.
Okay.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Oh, yeah, good one. Mm-hmm.
Santa Baby.
I love Santa Aww. Baby.
Silver Bells. All of these.
Wow, Silver Bells.
Yeah. Oh, and White Christmas. Irving Berlin.
I think
also,
I guessed White Christmas. Yeah, sorry, that was one of my guesses.
Listen, I goofed. I'll be honest. The font was a different color, and I got really confused.
Was it white? It was
no,
white on
it
white.
It was white.
also, Irving Berlin wrote God Bless America.
Yeah.
This is all those that. Are from Newsweek. But here's one more. Johnny Marks, who single-handedly wrote Rudolph, I Don't Want a Lot for Christmas, Rockin' Around the Christmas Tree, and many more Christmas songs. The dude just dominated the Christmas
market. Home Alone would not exist were it not for this man.
You gotta love Johnny Marks. So that's the war on Christmas. Sources for that one, Time Magazine, The New York Times, Newsweek, Snopes, Wikipedia, and hey, we wouldn't be here without you, Fox News. You certainly were a source. And then also that book, which I'm going to repeat because I really think everybody should check it out. It's such a great holiday read. Steven Nissenbaum's The Battle for Christmas. The best part about that book is it just is not dry at all. And it takes such a wonderful journey that really kind of stops around the modern day stuff. So if the back half of this, you won't get too much of that. If you want to just know more about how people are celebrating Christmas and fighting for it on both sides, you should definitely check out that book.
That's awesome.
Get it
you know
for Christmas.
What didn't you didn't tweet out to ask for reader-only memories?
Reader-only memories.
Oh, boy. I can't police you guys. You're just on your own. What
I know.
Can I
well,
say?
I mean, also, like, what would we have done? We would have been like, who did you lose in the battle for Christmas?
I do want to, since we don't have that section, I do want to call out, if you happen to get the chance to watch the Chilling Adventures of Sabrina Christmas special, It happens to be all about the Yule Lads, which we talked about a couple weeks ago. So it's a fun nod to something that we recently talked about. And you could be that snobby jerk like me to my wife saying, hey, guess what? I know all about the Yule Lads now. Mission accomplished. Cool. Thank you so much, Chris Plant.
We did it. It's been a season.
We did it. Yeah, this is going to be the end of the season. Thank you, Allegra. I want to thank Allegra as well.
Thank you.
This is going to be of the holiday tradition season that we've been doing. It's been a blast. I've had a really good time. Any favorite holiday traditions for you guys that jump out at you?
I think mine is the new tradition of doing what Allegra just did, which was this weird Jackie Onassis. She like lowered her wrist to her waist and was like, thank you.
That's great. You can say that instead of Merry Christmas or Happy Holidays.
Every time you get a present on the holidays. Thank you.
Thank you. Perfect.
So that's going to do it for us. We are going to take a break. We are going to go away, but not forever. Do not worry. Definitely stay subscribed to the History of Fun podcast feed. We're going to be having more episodes in the coming year. We're going to be doing some similar in this style. We're going to pick a theme and we'll do sort of mini seasons on that theme. So definitely stick with us. We love having you guys. We wanted to thank all of you for all the support that you've given us through this season and since the beginning of the show. We'd love to see all the reviews that you guys have been putting up, all the support on Twitter and everything like that is really terrific. Is there anything else that we needed to touch on?
We should leap the dips.
Well, but I wanted to do the outro.
You beat him to
first.
It. You beat
Listen,
him to it
I'm
again.
Just leaping ahead to the
Thank
dips.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to The History of Fun, where we explore the hidden backstories of the things you love. Leap the dips, everyone.
Thank you. Thank you.